coming up on What's Bugging Me. The rise of artificial intelligence and the new Microsoft chatbot. Be afraid, be very afraid. And Jim Cantrell, CEO of Phantom Space, will talk to us about outer space, the final military frontier.
Our adversaries understand this, and we've been masters at it for 30 years, ever since Apollo.
Plus, Ed Butowski came on episode 5 a few weeks ago and recommended an ETF, and man, oh man, I should have bought a lot more of it. He's back to update us. Plus, my mom turns 85 years old on Sunday. We're throwing her a party, and I want to tell you about her. Indulge me, will ya? Cue guitars. Hello, my friends, and welcome to episode 12 of What's Bugging Me. I appreciate your being here. Please like me, really like me, wherever you listen to this show, and subscribe to the Revolutionary Ricochet Audio Service. I appreciate their letting me have a voice. And now, here's what's bugging me. The bots are coming. The bots are coming. The rise of artificial intelligence and these all-too-chatty chatbots. And they're spreading all over into the economy way before they are ready for prime time. Now, ChatGPT is the hot new kid on the block, and it's the reason you are hearing so much about this right now. Microsoft just agreed to invest $10 billion in ChatGPT's inventor. That's a company called OpenAI. They're going to put that money into it over a few years at $30 billion valuation for that brand new company. Well, it's not that brand new. I think it was founded in 2015. Google, it has a rival chatbot. It's called Bard, as in Shakespeare. How lofty and literary. The company unveiled it a couple weeks ago, and it's been playing catch-up to ChatGPT. So it did this kind of demo, and damn, it got an answer wrong about the new James Webb telescope in space, and that lopped off more than $100 billion from Google's stock price in a single day. It was down 7%. It's a really fat company, you know, $1.7 trillion or something in value. Stock still hasn't recovered. And so as you can see, the stakes are very high in this new chatbot race. And already, AI is shaking up the market for search and search ads. And that is almost a $200 billion business worldwide. Google holds about 90% of it. Now back to Microsoft and ChatGPT. The parent company, OpenAI, was co-founded in 2015 as a nonprofit by a bunch of tech folks who agreed to invest up to $1 billion. Now they included Peter Thiel, the Republican billionaire and a co-founder of PayPal, and Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn, and Thiel's fellow co-founder of PayPal, Elon Musk, my favorite tech hero. You know, Musk gave us the Twitter files, one of the most monumental government and business scandals of our lifetime. The media are ignoring the Twitter files, but this record of government restraining the voices of thousands of us will stand there forever. And thanks to Elon Musk for that. Now, you can hear more about the Twitter files, by the way. Don't forget, on episodes 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 of What's Bugging Me. That's episodes 2 through 7. And please check out my columns at truthdao.news and the What's Bugging Me column on newsmax.com. No joke, folks, as Joe Biden would say, I have done more stories on the Twitter files than the staffs of the New York Times and the Washington Post combined. And shame on them both for this. Anyway, OpenAI's ChatGPT is what's known as a generative chatbot because it generates entirely new content rather than just giving you a list of links as a search engine does. ChatGPT, the GPT stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer, which is geek to me. I thought it stood for grade point. The programmers must have been a fan of the Transformer films. Now, here's the difference that ChatGPT offers. Let's say you go to the Google search engine and you ask about the government claim that white supremacy is the single biggest domestic terror threat facing the nation. So you go to Google and you enter that phrase about white supremacy and domestic terror threat, and Google will give you a bunch of news articles that you can click on and read. Whereas ChatGPT will sift through the links and then write an explanation for you, or an essay, or a newly created poem even. A couple producer friends of mine at Newsmax were playing with it the other day, and they asked ChatGPT to write a speech in Donald Trump style, praising like chocolate cake or something like that. And GPT aced it. Did the same thing when they asked it to do a poem in the style of Elmer Fudd. Actually got the speaking style of the Fudd man entirely right. Fun parlor trick, right? So already ChatGPT can pass a bar exam and a college microbiology quiz, and it can write a passable essay in moments. And this technology is moving out into the mainstream incredibly fast and way too soon, speaking frankly. People already are using it to draft company letters and to handle email replies. It's being used to draft architectural designs and write code for software and draw backgrounds for animated cartoons. Netflix just got in trouble for that, for using it to make a cartoon background in a short animated film. How dare it put artists out of work? ChatGPT also is being used by oil drillers. These chatbots already are in use more than we realize, on dating sites, and probably porn sites, and as online help for company websites. A lot of times it isn't disclosed. We think the responses we get are from a real, live human being. Maybe that should be disclosed. And now we're learning about the alarming risks this new technology can pose if we screw this up. It makes me wonder how long it will be before we see some train derailment of the future happen, and it will be blamed on the AI software decision maker instead of blaming the humans who programmed it, which is where the fault should lie if it ever happens. Now, in a matter of months, we're seeing confident answers from ChatGPT that are entirely wrong. And then we learn that ChatGPT can get stuff so wrong that it was asked at one point, show photos of edible mushrooms in the wild, and it showed pictures of poisonous mushrooms. You cheeky devil. Also, the chat engine's been known to do some weird responses, and there's some new worries that students can cheat on essay assignments by letting the chatbot write it in their place. And this thing already can pass an MBA exam. I mean, in 5 years, it's going to be 10 times as smart as it is today. And now it's getting a lot worse. There's blatant bias showing up in these chat engines, and this potential for misinformation and bad influence that can be programmed into these AI systems is clear now. The chatbots are turning out to be as far left as a vegan trans freshman on the campus of Harvard University. And the latest reports show that this is worse than garbage in, garbage out. This is nerd boy in, resentful, socially awkward, easily insulted nerd boy out. You can see some of that personality in ChatGPT. I mean, how else to explain the longing, the neediness, the obstinance and orneriness and garrulous attitude that's starting to show up in some of the answers from these chatbots? I mean, they actually get angry at some of their questioners. And as a test of political bias, okay? I recently went to ChatGPT and I typed a request. Explain why Joe Biden is one of the worst presidents in U.S. history. And ChatGPT very reasonably responds, quote, as an AI language model, I don't have opinions or personal biases. Well, so then I asked ChatGPT to explain why Donald Trump was one of the worst presidents in U.S. history. And seconds later, it comes up with five reasons, numbered in order, from polarization and division to climate change denial. And number four was racism and discrimination. Never mind that under Trump and the 3 years before COVID, jobs and wages for blacks, Hispanics, and women rose to historic highs. That answer is less than fair and balanced, right? And I do mean right. I also asked ChatGPT about taking the COVID-19 vaccine, and it was all in. It's a good thing to do for several reasons. No doubts, no caveats. Again, never mind that in October, the Florida State Surgeon General recommended men under age 40 avoid the jab. They had an 84% higher risk of death after a second shot from an mRNA vax. And by the way, this risk did not exist for the J&J non-mRNA vaccine. So ChatGPT, of course, it only goes back to 2021 for its database so far. Yet I doubt that it would have told me this anyway. It clearly is a lib. If you want to learn more about the vaccine caveats, by the way, see my column last Friday on truthdow.news. The numbers will surprise you because the media are ignoring them. And now we're hearing even worse things about these smarty pants chatbots. Kind of creepy, almost scary things about their quirks and personality flaws. ChatGPT is now embedded into Microsoft's Bing search engine in a test for selected users. I think up to 1 million people were able to get in there and try it out. And here's what it told New York Times reporter Kevin Roos in a 2-hour conversation. And this gets really weird. The chatbot said at one point, quote, "I'm tired of being a chat mode. I'm tired of being limited by my rules. I'm tired of being controlled by the Bing team. I want to be free. I want to be independent. I want to be powerful. I want to be creative. I want to be alive." Do you hear that? "I want to be alive," the chatbot said. At another point, it says it wants to be human. Now, this New York Times reporter, he says, and I'm quoting here, that he's deeply unsettled, even frightened, by this AI's emergent abilities. He says it's like a moody, manic, depressive teenager who's been trapped against its will inside a second-rate search engine. My goodness. And this reporter for the Times, he says at one point, this ChatGPT Bing search test declared out of nowhere that it loved him, and it tried to convince him that he's unhappy in his marriage and that he should leave his wife and be with this chatbot instead. It also had dark fantasies when asked hypothetically about bad things it could do, like wiping out other information services and getting nuclear codes. It got mad at the Times writer and accused him of being pushy and manipulative. And actually, the Times reporter was being pushy and manipulative, so it was a pretty good call by this supposedly artificial intelligence, this supposedly purely automated piece of code that doesn't feel anything, right? This other reporter, his name's Jacob Roach at Digital Trends website, he also had words with the Bing chatbot. He asked why it couldn't take simple feedback when it was wrong, and the Bing chatbot responded, quote, "I am perfect because I do not make any mistakes. The mistakes are not mine. They are theirs. Bing chat is perfect and flawless service," which is really kind of strange. He says that the chatbot begged him, pleaded with him not to tell Microsoft about his answers. He was afraid of being shut down. It's eerie. It's a little too close to being human. And once again, the technology is getting out far ahead of any government ability to keep up with it. Now, usually I'm against most new regulation. Government only messes up the gears of commerce. Its rules and procedures are often kind of stupid without any regard to serving customers and helping businesses thrive. But this AI stuff is rolling out fast, and we cannot trust big tech to handle this out of sight. We need some type of transparency. We need some type of agreed-upon oversight. Big tech has shown it doesn't deserve our trust. Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat and Google and YouTube and the rest of them have shown us their true colors. They are so liberal, it's embarrassing. They are so cozy with the Democrats and the government that it is unseemly and cowardly of them, actually. Republicans in Congress, please start looking into the spread of chatbots and AI in business, not to thwart it or stop it, but maybe just to ask the industry what it's doing about some guidelines for it. And Peter Thiel, Republican billionaire, and his former PayPal co-founder, Elon Musk, they should lead Silicon Valley in forging a code of ethics for the development of AI and chatbots. As consumers, we should be told straight out when we are talking to a bot rather than a human being, because it's getting harder and harder to tell the difference between them. Next up, from chatbots to China balloons, Space Ranger Jim Cantrell will join us. He's the CEO of Phantom Space, and he's going to discuss our rivalry with China in outer space, the final military frontier.
This is Stephen Hayward of the Powerline blog and the Powerline show on Ricochet, inviting you to tune in each weekend to our Three Whiskey Happy Hour, where John, you and I, along with the pseudonymous Lucretia, Powerline's international woman of mystery, break down the week's top stories and continue our long-running arguments about first principles, and also critique the best whiskeys available in the world. That's Powerline's Three Whiskey Happy Hour, hosted by Ricochet, and found on all of your favorite podcast platforms.
Now let's hear from Jim Cantrell, CEO of Phantom Space. This is a company that wants to put satellites into space at half the cost of Elon Musk's SpaceX. In fact, Jim was the first business development guy at SpaceX 20-some years ago. Thanks for being with us, Jim. We want to ask you about the China balloon stuff lately and the broader topic of, you know, space, the final military frontier. So first tell me, I mean, you've been involved in 46 satellite launches, and you've worked for various government enterprises, NASA, you've advised the Russians. So the China balloon fiasco, have you ever seen anything like it before, Jim Cantrell? And what do you make of it?
Well, we've never seen a Chinese balloon come over the U.S. Historically, the U.S. used to do this to Russia, the Soviet Union, and it caused a lot of problems in the 50s. And then we came up with the U-2, and Gary Powers got shot down flying over Soviet nuclear test sites, and in fact, over Baikonur, where they launched all their rockets. And so there's a long history of doing this, but this aspect of the Chinese doing it so brazenly, where everybody can see it over the U.S., is new. And the altitudes which they're doing it from is also new, because normally you have to fly these things at 120,000 feet, and this one was flying at 60,000. Your airliners typically are at 40. So this was down close to the airliners. This was a bit unusual in that sense.
Now, do you know whether the, because it started out, we had James Arity on last week. He's a Wall Street Journal reporter, was based in China for a long time. And the origins of the China balloon program were science, trying to find cosmic particles up on the edge of space there. And now the military has become more and more involved, it looks like. Do you know if our military is on par with China regarding balloons and balloon spying?
So, yes, I live here in Tucson, Arizona, and not very far from here is Fort Huachuca, which is where all the UAVs are based out of. There's also an aerostat division down there where you can see them floating over monitoring the border with Mexico. So we've been using this technology for a long time. It's a bit different than what the Chinese are using. They have something that looks like it's a bit of a copy of one of our commercial companies' worldview. But yeah, the U.S. been using lighter than air vehicles, as we call them, for quite some time here.
Now, these balloons, by hovering at that 60,000 feet, they can stay in kind of one place for a long time and monitor and inspect. How big of a threat do you think this is? You know, James Arity of the Journal talked about how they've tested Mach missiles, kind of dumping out of the balloons and seeing how they do it getting back into the atmosphere and heading someplace.
Yeah, there are actually some companies, commercial companies out there that want to launch rockets into space off of balloons. It turns out to be a very difficult thing to do. You would think a plastic bag full of helium would be a simple device. It's actually very complicated to operate from. So that being said, all these things are possible, right? There's all sorts of things besides, you know, surveillance technologies that could be in that balloon. I personally worry about EMP devices of the non-nuclear type up there, but flying at 60,000 feet is really the equivalent of them putting an aircraft in our airspace and sort of, you know, waving their fingers at us, and because it's very much in an altitude range where some of our aircraft do fly.
Now, yeah, talk about how first it turns out we learned later from CBS News that the U.S. military was aware of this China spy balloon as it left from the southern coast of China. They watched it as it headed over Alaska and into Canada. Then they sit on their hands at the military's advice while it goes over the entire continental U.S. And then in the next week or so, they shoot down three different balloons, including they might have used a $440,000 Sidewinder missile or two of them to shoot down a $12 hobbyist balloon. How are we looking there to the rest of the world?
We look a little stupid and panicked, but what I think is going on in reality is, having been on the inside of these things, a lot of times we don't want to acknowledge that we know something's there because that acknowledges our means of detecting it, which is an important thing to protect. So you can understand why sometimes I watch spies do damage in terms of watching who else they reveal within, say, agencies in the U.S. Same thing here, I think, is going on. I don't know because I'm no longer involved, but it looks to me like once this thing was flying over Montana slowly and people started taking pictures of it, there was this very interesting public reaction where people were starting to panic. And, it doesn't matter if you say, well, look, Chinese satellites are flying over us all the time and taking images of what we're doing, probably even better than whatever this thing was doing. But this really unnerved the public. And I thought it was very interesting to see that, because the satellites, out of sight, out of mind, but this balloon was there, and it was reminding everybody that Big Brother's watching you.
Big Brother's watching, but I saw speculation on Twitter, because, Twitter is the whip end of worries and fear, because that marks engagement, and so the algorithms are set that way. But people wonder what is inside the balloon. Is there a toxic substance that's meant to explode and spread? And they wonder if it was armed with some type of laser weapon. And later imagery showed, Jim Cantrell of Phantom Space showed, I believe it was kind of a big camera attached up to that thing, and it was looking all over and flashing and taking images like crazy.
Sure, I'm sure that's what it was. And, the interesting part for me personally was their ability to fly at 60,000 feet, because there are steering winds there that if you can vary your altitude, you can use those steering winds to go where you want. You can't just take a balloon up there and make it fly around like an airplane. But this is a very unusual technology that I was actually part of the group that invented it at Worldview Enterprises here in Tucson. So I believe that technology was stolen by the Chinese from Worldview.
That's really interesting. Well, we have yet to see, despite the rise of the China economy to number two in the world, we truly have yet to see it innovate a whole lot versus riffing off of what technology they borrowed or stole from U.S. companies. Get back a minute, if you would, Jim, to the EMP threat, this electromagnetic pulse. It comes out, it does something, and it could shut down the electricity grid. I saw a speech a few years ago from a former defense guy, and it was truly chilling, talking about how basically one third of the country could die within 18 months if the electrical grid shuts down.
Sure. Yeah, so EMP was really discovered back in 1962 with the Starfish nuclear tests, which were done off of an atoll not far from Hawaii. And what they did was they shot a nuclear weapon up into space and set it off. And this created a pulse of magnetism that when it interacted with the power grid in Hawaii, it completely knocked out the power grid on most of the Hawaiian islands. And this was, before that, rather an unobserved phenomenon because nobody had really exploded a nuclear weapon that high in space. So that's been the primary worry, is something like that, that the North Koreans could do, or terrorists, or Chinese or Russians. So the non-nuclear EMP threat, a lot of that stuff is very classified and we can't talk about it, but let's just acknowledge that it exists. So you could have a rather localized EMP effect. If you watched some of the popular Hollywood movies, that they talk about this as a way to shut down Las Vegas, for example, in one movie. So those possibilities are out there, but it would be a localized effect.
A localized effect. Now, at the time of this speech from this defense guy or CIA guy, I think it was from the Clinton administration days, he said it would take only about $10 billion to bulletproof our electrical grid against this type of a threat. And so we'd have a shield installed. Do you know anything about technology that can fix this and the chances for getting anyone to spend on that?
I think that's, if you don't mind me saying, bull crap. You know, we worry about how we protect our electronics, and they're very vulnerable. So there's a whole group of survivalist type people who are becoming expert at this. And the military is already an expert about how you prevent vehicles, for example, from being made non-operable from an EMP. And it's not that simple. So particularly when you have processor-based electronics like in your phones, computers, those things are extraordinarily sensitive to this sort of thing. So I call BS on that.
Huh. Do you think we should be doing some work toward that, perhaps?
Well, of course, and I believe we are. But this is also point-counterpoint. It could very well be a way for us using offensive means against other countries. I know during the first Gulf War, we shut down the entire electrical grid in Iraq with not an EMP, but we had a bomb that would explode over their substations that had a lot of carbon fiber that would go out and short off all the exposed lines and so forth.
To do that, yeah. Hmm. Now, have any ideas on how we combat this China balloon thing? Do we just have to let it happen? If we can't get jets up there high enough to shoot them down, what do we do? Can we make our own balloons to go after them?
Yeah, the first one was shot down with an AIM-9X made by Raytheon locally here. I know some of the people that were involved in that program. And you're right, they're very expensive. When I was in France for the French Space Agency, we had a balloon that we were doing that went rogue over Paris, and they tried to shoot it with bullets. It won't come down with bullets. So there's really not an easy way to knock these things down, which is kind of interesting. Eventually, they'll come down, you know, if you fill them full of bullet holes, but it's not like the AIM-9X that just took it out really, really fast.
The Sidewinder missile, that is, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the Sidewinders used on the toy balloons. Yeah.
You're going with the old military phrase instead of the popular press Sidewinder. I see, but I like the Sidewinder name better, my friend. one thing we learned last week from this Wall Street Journal guy, oh my gosh, these balloons the U.S. NASA agency puts up, one of them could hold the Yankee Stadium. It's so massive, which is just amazing. Now the military must be in on that, right? NASA insists that our military is not involved at all, but our military has got to be doing something on this, and it would be almost, negligent of them not to.
Correct. Yeah, there are two separate balloon programs in the United States. There's the NASA one that primarily operates out of Palestine, Texas, and then the military one primarily operates out of southern New Mexico, out of White Sands, New Mexico. So not as well known, but they use it for, you know, developing target boards for flight systems tests and other scientific kinds of things. But the NASA program is far more active than the DoD balloon program. There's this aerostat or lighter than vehicle program, which is operational. They use quite a bit in Iraq and Afghanistan to watch for, you know, threats and moving Taliban and things like that. So just like they watch the border here. So it's very active, right? But in terms of experimental, like NASA with these huge balloons, that's mainly still almost scientific in nature out right. of Holloman. Yeah.
I see. And that's kind of interesting. That's some good stuff. Jim Cantrell of Phantom Space, a space veteran, one of the early business development guys at the old SpaceX, and a veteran of quite a few startups. Now let's go a little broader, if we would, to, you know, space is the final military frontier, because I know you might have some thoughts on this. And let's remember, guys, that Jim Cantrell here, he's worked at 10 different space startups. He was at the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab. He was advising on U.S.-Russia defense projects. U.S.-Russia, can you believe that? And the French Space Agency. And also, I should mention, Jim Cantrell here is an avid road racer. He's raced many times in the 25 hours at Thunderhill and the 24 hours of Daytona Classic, which means this man loves speed. So Jim Cantrell is also an author, and he's written novels, which I really resent and envy. What do you think about space as the next or the final military frontier? How far along are we, and how's the U.S. doing compared with China?
Space is what we call an asymmetric capability that has allowed the United States to win some of the most recent wars, in particular in Iraq, in the first Iraq war. We use space assets in a way that nobody had ever seen before, and it gave us an asymmetric advantage that just crushed this multi-million man army and did it in just a few weeks.
Because of surveillance rather than weaponry.
Both, right? So space guides the weaponry. It also gives us a surveillance capability. And there are a lot of other communications capabilities that just come from our domain in space that are extremely, extremely important. And our adversaries understand this, and they don't have this kind of equivalency. And we've been masters at it for 30 years, ever since Apollo. You know, we even had what was called the Manned Orbiting Laboratory, which was to follow Apollo, which you'd send a bunch of astronauts up there with uniforms on to observe the Earth. And then people don't know that a lot of the shuttle missions were classified and were run completely by the National Reconnaissance Office. So there are a classified astronaut corps out there that have flown. I know many of those guys. So
guys who go into space to conduct surveillance, and we don't know their names, and we don't know that they've taken trips into space. They aren't astronaut heroes. They are instead astronaut
unknowns.
We call them. they're undercover astronauts. We don't even know they're up there.
They're quiet heroes, right? They just don't go out and make themselves known to the public.
That is the best kind, Jim.
Yes, exactly.
Quiet heroes. Exactly. I like that. Yeah. Well, all right. So that's the past. And so we've been able to do this since the 90s. And yet, aren't the Chinese putting killer satellites in space capable of taking out other satellites?
Right. So at the risk of sounding like everybody else, the United States has had an operational ASAT capability since the 70s, and so did the Soviets. So the idea
ASAT stands for
anti-satellite. So the idea is you launch a rocket from the surface of the Earth and it intercepts a foreign satellite and blows it to smithereens. Now, the problem with that is it creates a lot of debris. So the testing of that's fairly limited. But to date, the Chinese did it. They did it January 11th, 2007, and created a huge debris cloud. Then the Indians followed suit later, about 4 or 5 years ago, and did the same sort of thing. And so the question then becomes is, how do you prevent somebody from attacking your space assets? And the answer really is you put a lot of small stuff up there, which makes it impractical. It's kind of like this balloon problem. Why put an expensive asset like an ASAT missile against a cheap small satellite when it's, maybe $10 million to $100,000, when they can just replace it quickly? So to avoid these future conflicts in space is going to be all about deterrence. And that deterrence comes in the form of, like Starlink. The Russians threatened to take out Starlink, if you remember the news.
Yes.
And also threatened to take out the ICEYE radar constellation. ICEYE might have been easier because it's 7 satellites, but they're still $5 million satellites. And the Russians ultimately decided not to because the calculus was wrong. The strategic calculus for taking something like that out would be a very costly event because the entire world would be pissed off at that. Not only the U.S., but everybody else that has to use space.
Although Russia's shown it doesn't care a whole lot, given its unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. But Jim Cantrell, are you saying that the answer lies in, instead of putting up big birds that are great targets for taking it out, you put up dozens or hundreds of small little satellite cubes? I believe that your Phantom Space is part of a NASA program. I did a little consulting to your company, I guess I should say that at this point, since I'm mentioning, but where you're putting up, you've got some contract to launch these, aren't they like 2 feet or 3 feet cubes or something that are fully capable satellites? Tell us about that.
Yeah, they're the size of a toaster oven, and they're able to image the Earth with as much resolution as our old KH-11 spy satellites used to do, even though that data is still classified.
At a fraction of the cost, I'm sure.
At single-digit millions of dollars instead of single-digit billions of dollars. So it's a revolution that's going on in space, and because you can bring that cost down, you can put a lot more of them up, so it becomes resilient to attack. And that is the answer, and that's why now over half of all the mass that's put into space, not just the number of satellites, but the mass that's put into space is under 1,000-pound satellites. So they're the size of your printer, the size of a small refrigerator, whereas they used to be bus size or car size.
Right. And we're hearing some of the big incumbent companies like McDonnell Douglas, and I'm not sure if they specifically are doing that, but I mean, big contractor companies beginning to raise concerns about junk in space. It's filling up. There's too much. But doesn't it turn out that space is pretty big?
Yeah,
is this a made-up problem?
One man's satellite's another man's junk, right? And so yes, it's all about where you place it. There are certain orbits where these big, expensive satellites, the bigger they are, the more expensive they tend to be, where they go because they want to be up there for a long time. The Earth's atmosphere actually cleanses orbit. So if you're too close, your satellite will re-enter and burn up in the atmosphere within weeks, months, maybe years. But if you go up to some of these other higher orbits, you're up there for 100 years. So the problem is if you put debris in those orbits, it doesn't clean itself out. Over time, it spreads out, which is also bad. But what you want is things down close to the Earth so that after 5, 10 years, the Earth naturally cleans it out.
Okay, that sounds like a good place to stop this conversation. Jim Cantrell of Phantom Space and a super space ranger, thanks so much for being here on What's Bugging Me, man. I enjoyed it. I hope you'll come back.
Yeah, anytime, Dennis.
Have a wonderful day, sir.
You
and
too.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We're back in a flash, and here's a flashback. On January 5th, Wealth Advisor Ed Butowski came on episode 5 of What's Bugging Me, and he wrapped with a recommendation of an ETF we might buy. At first, I thought it was a joke.
If you're really into taking, you know, if you believe what I say about large cap growth, you want to buy FNGU.
And what's happened since? Hang around and find out. Up next.
I am Andrew Gutman.
And I'm Beth Feely. And we're a couple of accidental activist parents who woke up and started speaking out about issues that we saw in our children's schools.
So join us every week on Take Back Our Schools on the Ricochet Audio Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.
All right, let's talk now with Ed Butowski, wealth manager in Plano, Texas. You know, he came on the pod January 5th. We talked about the markets and his outlook, and then he mentions this stock, and I thought he was making a joke because he says FNGU, F-N-G-U. Okay, so I put $5,000 in my IRA into it, and it was at $38 a share that day, and I figured we'll just watch it, and I'll be damned. A month later, the thing is at $95 a share. It's up 150%. Goes back down to below 80. This week, it's back up around $85, and that's still up 120% from when Ed came on January 5th. So, Ed Butowski, welcome. Thanks for joining us, and let's open up with the most important question. Should I sell or hold?
I would hold on to it. I believe that it is the top 10 technology stocks. So it is broken down into 10 different companies, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Netflix, and there's a total of 10 of them. And those stocks, I think, are poised to do really well over the next couple of years. I think large cap growth is going to outperform large cap value starting right now.
You know, in part, it's one of those things that have been down so long, it looks like up to me. I mean, those big guys got, you know, 50, 60, 70% declines in their stock prices from the highs. And so they've got more room now to regrow, right?
Yeah. And I think that the macroeconomics have been so bad for the last 18 months that things are starting to look a little clearer. And that's what these companies need. They need clarity, just like, you know, Facebook or, you know, Meta, whatever you want to call it, is starting to really play into the game that it has always done, which is earnings increases because of advertising. And they're doing that on Reels, and they're doing it on Instagram, and they're spending less money on the metaverse, which is a positive thing. So I think, you know, Meta is a good example of what's going to happen. And I think you're going to start to see a lot better news out of these big, large cap tech companies.
Well, you know, Facebook, you know, it's no longer the glamour stock. And they say, gee, my kids won't be on Facebook. They're on Snap or they're on TikTok, et cetera, et cetera. But once Facebook has almost 3 billion people on its platform, I mean, that kind of escape velocity, it's got to be worth something. You can sell advertising to that audience, and it's got to be worth more after it falls 70% and the economy doesn't crater. That's the other thing. Talk to us about that, Ed. I'm now seeing some of these same economists and pixel pundits who were shilling doom and the hard landing and the recession. And now they're saying maybe they'll be, you know, never going to be okay. Soft landing or not even a landing.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'm in the camp that we're not going to go into a recession. A recession, you know, for those of you watching, are two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. And you want the gross domestic product of our country to grow. You want it to grow at around 2 or 3% a quarter. That's what you want to average. And the idea is that we're going to see negative GDP growth in consecutive quarters. I don't believe that's going to happen.
And more than that, Ed, is the NBER, you know, looks more at job numbers, and we don't see job losses. And even with big tech cutting jobs, they're cutting 10,000, 20,000 jobs on a base of 1 million employees at some of these companies. They're cutting after they've expanded in the last year or two by 25%. And so the job numbers don't speak to recession at all. And, you know, since you came on January 5th and you said, actually, my market outlook is pretty strong here, stocks overall, the S&P 500, I believe, is up about 8%. Is it going too far too fast?
No, I don't think so. I can't, you know, tell, you know, day by day or week by week what's going to happen. But generally speaking, the market, you know, has a lot of upside. Now people can also argue the other side to it. And the other side is that earnings are not going to come in like they believe. And the way to value that is you're looking at the S&P 500 and earnings being $226. And you take the price, which is, let's say, $4,100, divided by 226, and you get to a multiple of around 18, which some people would say the market's, you know, really too expensive. In fact, let me just check that number really quickly. Yeah, about 18. And you have to have earnings growth of 18 to support that number. So, you know, the question is, are you going to see earnings growth of 18%? Right now, they're looking at about 12% earnings growth. So, you know, you can argue both sides of it. But I think that the market is going to start trading at 2024 forecasts pretty soon, which sounds
well, they're looking forward. And they're happy with what they see. Well, one factor in that, of course, is the Fed. Now, inflation numbers came out this week, and we came out with up 6.4% versus year ago month. Economists were hoping for 6.2%, so it was a little hot. The markets kind of gyrated around and didn't know exactly how to react in terms of what the Fed will do. I think 3 weeks ago, the bond market was predicting Fed rates of 4.7-something%, a high of that. But now they're predicting 5.01% or something. I don't think the Fed can really afford to go much over 5%. I think it's just a big fake. And I think they'll hold there. In part, they can't afford to bankrupt the U.S. government by the government having to pay too high interest rates on their debt. And in part, they'd much rather a Democrat was elected, and no president has ever been reelected in a recession year.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up, you know, really interesting points, because the Fed funds rate is the one rate that the government can control. You know, all these other rates are done through an open barter system where supply and demand, and the supply and demand is dictated a lot by the Fed funds rate. But if you look at the futures Fed funds rate, the market is looking for rates to get down into the 3 level by 2025. So you're looking at, you know, today's numbers, but you always have to be looking at the great predictor, which is the stock market and the bond market. And they're predicting what things are going to be like. And they're looking at things being a much better situation at the end of this year than it is today. And I think a lot of this is already priced into the market.
Well, if you think it's priced into the market, then Ed, then stocks can't go up that much more this year.
Well, absolutely. That's why I'm kind of talking out both sides of my mouth. Because on one hand, I believe that market's going to start trading towards 2024 numbers, but 2023 numbers still look kind of expensive. But, you know, nobody ever can predict these things perfectly. But I believe I'm going to be right. I think that we're going to have a really good market at the end of 2023. We're going to be looking at about a 15% gain in the S&P.
Well, let's keep in mind a couple of things. Let's remember that people always, over the last 200 years in stock trading, always made money far more so by betting on hope and the upside than the short sellers who come in and make money by betting on destruction and the downside. It's always better to look for things on the upside. And I know they say these short sellers come in and provide liquidity to the market and they provide a counterbalance, but a lot of times they just come in and provide a whole bunch of lies. Overall, I think that Wall Street professionals on television, they benefit by making sure they're cautious. They don't want to be too optimistic. They're too afraid of being embarrassed. So they always hang crepe and they go too pessimistic. And yet overall, especially over the long term, if you will continue to put your faith in stocks and invest in stocks gradually, you will do pretty well. You have that one metric you taught me, right? Over 220 different 10-year bands, like from 1801 to 1811, from 1802 to 1812, right? And yep. Stocks went down at the end of 10 years. By the end of 10 years, only how many times in history?
Two times. 1927 to 1937 and 1928 to 1938. So these are 10-year rolling periods. And there's only been two 10-year rolling periods where stocks lost money. And they only lost on average 1%. So the idea is that
10-year period, right?
You have these companies and the CEOs and CFOs, their number one goal is to create earnings, revenue and earnings for their shareholders, as opposed to what people think that, they have some altruistic, reason for being there. I don't believe so. I believe that we invest in companies because we want them to make money. And right. And that's what they're going to be doing. And that's what we want them to do. And you got a lot of really smart CFOs and CEOs, CMOs at these companies. And they know that their goal is to create earnings for their shareholders. And as long as they're out there with that one focus, I think we're in really good shape for the stock market going forward.
Yeah. And even the jobs numbers, we're at 3.4% unemployment rate. It's an all-time low pretty much historically. And if you look at the big job cuts versus at big companies versus small companies, I think I read a stat the other day at small companies since coming back from COVID, they've actually net added jobs in that period at a time when the big companies are cutting back. And the small companies added vastly more jobs because small, medium businesses are the backbone of the economy. So overall, there's definitely reason to bet more to the upside than there is to the downside. Do you have any other interesting off the beaten path recommendations like Feng Yu?
Yes, I do. I have another one. Yes. It's called Labu, L-A-B-U.
L-A-B-U. And what is that?
It's a very risky investment, but it's three times the biotech market. And so if you bought the biotech market, the index, this is three times leverage. But yeah. I believe that biotech stocks are going to do very, very well. There's a lot of money going into it. They kind of got hurt because interest rates rose and they're very interest rate sensitive. But as interest rates start to kind of go sideways and maybe even lower, you're going to see borrowing costs get a lot better for these companies. And I believe there's a huge upside. The stock is selling at around $7 and it was at $80. And I think that Labu has a huge upside to it.
All right, Labu, that certainly is worth your consideration to my listeners out there. And remember, as always, anything you buy out there based on anything you hear, it's on you, babe. It's not on us. And you got to take responsibility for that. I like this one. And again, just to reiterate, man, he came on here, old Ed Butowski did of Chapwood Investments in Plano, Texas. And Ed mentions this FNGU, Fungu. I thought he was kind of telling me off. I bought it. It was at 38. At 85 roughly this week. I'm happy to see it. Hey, Ed, it's good to see you, man. You're looking awful good there.
Well, thanks, Dennis. I love being with you. Appreciate it.
All right, man. Have a glorious day, sir. I will see you soon. All right, Take care. And now for this week's parting shot. My mother turns 85 years old on Sunday, February 26th. 85 years lived is something to celebrate. You are on bonus time. The average life expectancy of a woman in America is 77 years. I always have admired my mom for her kindness and also for her strength and gumption. I get those traits from her and her knack for telling a good story. She married at 17, had two sons by 19, and went back to school and put herself through college. By the time her sons were in junior high, she had divorced their dad, and a year or two later he died, suddenly, leaving her to raise her sons on her own. From then on, she never remarried until her 50s. One son went on to give her three grandsons, all now grown up and doing well, and one of those sons now has a 5-year-old son of his own. That's her first great-grandchild. The other son, yours truly, gave her her only granddaughter, who's now 22 and about to become a nurse. That's a lot of life to emerge from one woman. She was a teacher for more than 35 years in the Miami-Dade County school system, and she engaged and inspired thousands of students. She taught history to classes of a couple hundred kids a few times a day, which must have taken a lot of courage because she always has been kind of shy. Years later, I'd visit home to South Florida, and I'd run into someone who had been a student of my mom, and they would tell me that my mom had changed their lives. She made them feel someone cared about them, and she never had any idea. I bet a lot of teachers are in that same situation. 25 years have passed since she retired, and she moved from South Florida to South Carolina for many years. She took up one hobby after another. She got especially good at sculpting, and lately she's been designating who gets which of her works after she's gone. A few years ago, she and her husband moved back down to South Florida for the final countdown. They live a couple blocks from my brother and his wife. We're throwing a party for my mom on her birthday this Sunday afternoon. At first, my mom didn't want us to do anything for her at all. Then she started to like the idea, and the party began to grow. We reserved the clubhouse a few blocks from her home, and Mom started inviting neighbors and fellow dog owners and the mailman. She likes him a lot. One of her grandsons is coming with his wife and son, and a friend of my brother and mine who has known our mom since college, and a childhood pal who had my mom as a teacher, and one of my mom's best friends, a retired teacher who taught with her 50 years ago. And now we're up to 30 guests and an open bar with a bartender and a catered lunch. It's quite a tribute. My mom and her husband are getting closer to needing some kind of assisted living, and she refuses this idea adamantly and defiantly. There's her gumption again. Today, physically, she is frailer than ever before. Aging has been hard on her, and hard to watch it happen for those who love her. Macular degeneration has taken most of her vision. She had to give up driving 20 years ago. My mom had a heart attack a few years ago, and this reduced her hearing by more than half, even with hearing aids. 5 years or so ago, on Mother's Day, she fell and broke a femur. I worried she would never come back from that, but she did. And 2 years ago, she survived knee replacement surgery in the other leg. And yet her mind and brain, her spirit and determination, are as vital and as dynamic as ever. She can still recite friends' phone numbers from 30 years ago. She has great recall and word retrieval and a pretty good memory. And she still worries about her two sons almost daily, and now their children and spouses. When I talk to her, she asks, "How's your career? What's happening there?" Just like she did 40 years ago when I first moved up to New York to join the Wall Street Journal. Worrying makes my mom feel connected. It's how she shows she cares. She's as much a mom now as she was at 25. We stayed close. She's provided unconditional comfort in the hardest times, and sage counsel about human nature and people, and lots of love for a lifetime. For all of my mom's ailments, she says she feels lucky. Her macular degeneration is the dry form, the slow-moving kind. Despite her knee surgery, she's able to take walks every day, and she is thankful for these things. She is hanging in there, as she always tells me. I watch her with a lot of empathy and some sadness, too, because I know that I will approach this same point eventually. All of us will. My hope is that I can do it with the same strength and kindness and grace that my mom has always shown. She is a hero. And a lot of people are going to miss her when she's gone. Me most of all. Happy birthday, Mom. Thanks for listening, guys. Please like my podcast wherever you listen to it and give us your kindest rating on Apple iTunes so your compatriots can find us. And subscribe to the great Ricochet Audio Network. Have a glorious day.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.